everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to meet with an expert who has agreed to share his or her views, many of which it is my hope will increase your critical thinking skills and certainly your awareness of the world in which we live. I am very pleased to introduce to you today's guest, who I'm pretty clear will encourage you to stretch your way of thinking about various people in the world. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Eve Merrim, who is the author of Psychopathy Within. Dr. Merrim is described as a clinical and forensic psychologist. We're going to find out what that means. A Jungian-oriented psychotherapist. She is also an author. She's studying. Dr. Eve Merrim, busy person that you are, thank you for taking out the time to join us here on Mind Talk.
Oh, it's my delight and pleasure. Thank you.
Now, Dr. Merrim, I want to start off with asking you some definitions just so that everyone who's hearing our conversation is on the same page.
Sure.
I described you as a clinical and forensic psychologist. I think most people get clinical, but what about forensic? What does that mean to be a forensic psychologist?
Well, forensic simply means that whatever we're referring to is associated with the court or with the legal system. So I have experience working with forensic cases, meaning cases that are involved in some kind of court activity, either therapy clients that are referred through the court system. It could be probation or parole or an attorney. And I also served on a panel where I went into the prisons and did evaluations that are also referred to as forensic evaluations because the findings are presented in court. They would have to do with risk that the person interviewed would commit another offense, such as the kind that got them into trouble in the first place. So I don't know if that...
That absolutely explains it. You know, I think, again, the idea that someone can be engaged in something that is connected to the court system really makes it easier, I would believe, for people to understand that part of your world. So for you're a forensic psychologist and a Jungian-oriented psychotherapist. Okay, what does that mean?
Well, it means that I'm straddling two pretty different worlds.
Kind of, sort of.
Well, I've had an interest in Jung and his ideas for probably more than 30 years. And a Jungian approach to psychology or therapy basically reflects incorporating an understanding of the unconscious into all that we are and do. Jung was a colleague of Freud. Basically, Freud was a mentor to him, and then he certainly became well-known in his own right and ended up having his own way of working with the unconscious. That was basically what the two of them shared. And, of course, similarities, but a Jungian approach to psychology or to therapy is pretty open-ended. It's much less structured in terms of how we interpret the work that we do than Freud. So I am. I've been working, doing therapy for many years, and although the nature of what I do is pretty eclectic, I would work with someone based on what they bring and seem to need. The Jungian ideology has sort of infused my own thinking in my life. His approach to working with therapy, for example. We refer to that as analytical psychology as opposed to a Freudian approach is psychoanalytic. And there's quite a bit of a difference. I worked for many years I've had a lot of different jobs, and I worked for the County of Orange for 26 years, had 10 different jobs, and that is more of a, like, involving social work, child abuse, the courts, the juvenile courts, family situations, and then I retired from that in 2009. That was the same year that my father died, and my father figures prominently in this writing as well.
Yes.
And at that point, I was freer to pursue more of my interest in a Jungian approach to therapy. I, at the same time, was serving on this panel that I briefly referred to when you asked me about forensics, and that was work in the prisons that involved the courts and that kind of thing. And I talk about that in the book, too, and the book kind of represents the coming together of those three things, basically the forensic piece, the Jungian ideas, and then my experience with my father. So I kind of bridged out on your question there, but in 2009 was when I was able to also begin studying a little more in a focused way in the Jungian field. And then of late, like the last couple of years, I have been part of this training program. It's one of many institutes around the world that train clinicians to become Jungian analysts. So that's that piece of it for me now, is that I go to Santa Fe once a month and participate in training through the umbrella organization is referred to as the IRSJA. It's the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts. So that was probably a lot more than what you had asked. I hope I stayed clear.
Well, I didn't limit you to two sentences, so I think it's mm-hmm. fine. You did okay. mention the County of Orange, and that, of course, is Orange, California.
Correct, yes.
All right.
Right, and now there's one in Florida, too.
So let's look at, you know, on the one hand, the Jungian perspective, as you describe it, it's open, it looks a lot at the unconscious. So there are lots of different interpretations that can come from that approach. And then you've got the forensic approach, which is really black or white.
Right, right.
And you also say that you find yourself questioning the forensic approach to psychopathy. So tell, right. Well, let's start off with what exactly psychopathy is. There's a view, I think, in the world of psychopaths and sociopaths, and sometimes right. those interpretations get merged, sometimes not. Right. But I think, in general, they're kind of seen as these disreputable, rotten human beings
right.
for whom there is no cure, and you really just don't want to be around them ever. So
right.
what's a psychopath?
Well, basically what the book presents is a different definition of psychopathy than the one you refer to that we assume we are talking about when we say somebody is a psychopath. It's true that those two terms, psychopath and sociopath, are often used interchangeably, but I write about that as well because they really mean somewhat different things. And a sociopath is more like what we associate with criminal behavior or antisocial personality disorder. It means crimes against society. So society's rules, expectations, authority, that kind of thing. Whereas a psychopathy is something a little bit different, and it refers literally to a problem, a wounded psyche, a problem at a deeper level. And it gets kind of tricky because when we think about it, many of the characteristics that we expect and are even necessary for success in business, in politics, dare I say, you know, being sort of somewhat callous, being able to be charming and glib and to manipulate in order to achieve a certain goal, those are all things that we accept in our culture, and yet those dimensions of a psychopathic personality are certainly definitely characteristic. What I talk about in the book is a new definition of psychopathy that is a gradated definition. In other words, it's along a scale. And the definition that I believe makes sense most is the one that is posited. I didn't make this up, but back in Jung's era, Adolf Guggenbuhl Craig, it's a mouthful, but he was an analyst in Switzerland at the time, and he wrote a book called The Emptied Soul, and basically what he was doing is proposing this idea, and he originated this idea of psychopathy as representing something missing in the soul, like a gap, and he talked about that gap where there isn't the normal kind of relatedness and compassion and emptiness, that what that also suggests is that when Eros, this idea of love in the greater sense of the word, not just being in love, but a sort of passionate connection to life and to people and perhaps even to, you know, art or whatever it is that we are, that means the most to us in life, that Eros has the capacity to heal that gap, okay? Now, this doesn't mean that, of course, extreme psychopaths don't exist, and I absolutely acknowledge that, and certainly in terms of my forensic work, you're right, it's a whole different kind of definition of psychopathy, but we need that in the courtroom, and the reason that we do is so that decisions can be made. Basically, the courtroom is all about judgment, and so when we measure psychopathy in a forensic way, we use risk assessment tools that are very specific. If a person hits a certain score on one of these tools, then we say, yes, this guy really has extreme psychopathy, what we would call a psychopath. But I'm going to throw another little wrench in the works here.
Uh-oh.
When I was training to do these evaluations in the prisons, one of the main state-of-the-art tool that we use as forensic psychologists in order to measure psychopathy is called the Hare Psychopathy Checklist Revised. And Robert Hare created this tool. It's a very refined tool at this point. It divides psychopathy into four categories, and I won't go into all of that. But basically, he's saying that there's this whole range of characteristics that represent psychopathy, and they range from interpersonal and affective characteristics through more of the kind of thing that we think of when we think of a psychopath, i.e. propensity for violence, you know, and criminal characteristics. Those two halves are pretty different, because you can have somebody who's a serious criminal, and I mean, I work with this, that they don't necessarily have high psychopathy. They may actually have, you know, loving connections to others. I mean, they may be screwed up in lots of other ways and have behaviors that are certainly problematic, but it's not necessarily the same as psychopathy. On the other hand, you've got individuals who have no criminal record and propensities, and yet demonstrate this sort of an affective void. Something is missing. There's a callousness. There's a lack of connection. And, you know, with some hesitation, I have to acknowledge that that is the realm in which my father had some overlap, although he certainly was never a criminal.
Let me ask you this, yeah. Because you've kind of thrown a lot of different pieces at us. The first thing that strikes me is, as you talk about psychopathy as an experience in which the individual has some empty spaces, there's just stuff lacking within them. Well, when you say it that way, now it's hard for me to be really mad and want to throw all the psychopaths away. Now I'm thinking, oh, gee, they had, you know, a troubled childhood, and we really need to do X, Y, and Z, which is really counter, certainly, to the court approach. And it's certainly counter to how, again, I think most people think about it. Then you throw in that psychopaths can be charming and wonderful, and those are tools for I think I can quote you, some business people, some politicians. So now I'm all confused because it seems like it's a good thing. Now it's a not a good thing. It's a bad thing. Help us out.
Okay. It's not that it's a good thing as much as that this is a character quality that has nuances. And it's very relevant that we're having this conversation right now, I think, because we are in a culture that is so polarized. You know, we need to demonize an other. And frankly, a Jungian approach to even that idea that we need to make somebody into, like a group of people, say, into the bad guys,
mm-hmm.
it suggests work that we need to do on ourselves. Because what we do when we can't tolerate aspects of ourselves is we project them onto others. Then we can make those people, you know, the bad thing that we can then, you know, put on an island somewhere. And it never works. So basically, I'm not suggesting that there aren't people that have such extreme psychopathy that they should be. You know, they can't be around the rest of us. They're dangerous, just as you suggest. And I think when you say, put the psychopaths somewhere and not deal with them, I think that's the population you're referring to, and I agree. I mean, the training that I started to mention earlier in the context of my verbosity was one where we were learning about this tool, Robert Hare's tool, and we were watching these nonstop documentaries, and they were the documentaries were about, like, the Hillside Strangler and Ted Bundy. I mean, the worst of the worst, these murderers.
Pretty awful stuff.
Awful stuff. Serial killers. Turn my stomach. So we're watching these one after the other, and then at the end of it, it's like 40 psychologists in the room. Each tape, we had to score these guys on the PCLR, on this forensic tool to measure psychopathy. Well, none of them had extreme high scores. They were all in the mid-range. And so I'm thinking to myself, what are we measuring?
Yeah, that would kind of blow everybody away, I would think.
Well, one would think. And so I asked I asked the instructor, you know, what is it, why is this happening? What are we measuring, you know, if this is the case? And she looked at me and said, well, that's a good question.
Okay, let me ask you this, mm-hmm. because you've talked about the Robert Hare psychopathy checklist, and
right.
there's, you know, I recognize that's what's being being used, but there's also been some pushback, I think, from some folks that this is a tool that certainly he gets compensated for, which on the one hand, I don't think it's a problem, but apparently he's structured in such a way that in order to use it, he has to be compensated for it. So then there's that sort of little undercurrent of, is this really accurate, or is this his way of making extra money? And, you know, so it all, I mean, it's psychology, right? So it all gets complicated, and there are 6,000 different theories for every one.
Right. Well, I mean, I think what it comes down to, and I, you know, his tool is a good tool. It's just not, I think the reason that it may fall short in the way that I'm describing, because, for example, the worst of the worst don't come up with high scores and that kind of thing, I think what that reflects is less, you know, I mean, you can find statistics to support pretty much anything.
That's true.
Right. And I think that one of the reasons we have difficulty with this tool is not because the categories don't nail it, as because we can't, it's not an all or nothing kind of a characteristic. And so these guys, for example, that we were measuring, they had problems somewhere. What they have come to believe is that it's the affective and interpersonal categories that kind of raise the alarm bells more than any kind of obvious criminal history, because a lot of these guys, these serial murderers, they didn't have criminal histories. You couldn't look at them and say, oh, well, they've been violent and, you know, since they were kids, or, you know, they didn't have the characteristics of, like, an antisocial personality disorder. They had other kinds of disturbances that were more subtle. And they may have actually had families and had relationships and had stability in some of the areas that we look at when we're trying to see whether somebody's going to be trouble.
So in fact, what you're saying then, I mean, clearly what the checklist almost underscores is what you've said up to this point, which is that there really is a range.
Right.
There are gradations of,
right.
Of psychopathy, and that we can't
yes.
just say one psychopath is just like every psychopath and, you know, close the
yeah.
door so long. Dr. Marin, we're going to take a break,
yeah.
and when we come back, we will continue. Just before the break, I know there are some folks who want to know more about the Robert Hare checklist, and that's Robert, R-O-B-E-R-T, Hare, mm-hmm. H-A-R-E, Psychopathy
Correct.
Checklist Revised, which
Correct.
Is the PCL-R.
R.
We'll be right back, folks.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer.
Sure. Dr. Marum, in your book, which I'm not sure that I have given the title of, Psychopathy Within,
yeah.
by Eve Marum, that's M-A-R-A-M, you bring up an interesting theory that was offered by a colleague of yours, which is really interesting, suggesting that psychopathy is not a mental disorder, but an evolutionary adaptation, a sort of genetic aberration initially designed to further the species' survival. So now it throws it into an even broader context of understanding, I would suggest, as you think about who they are, how they came to be how they are, and what we need to do as a society. And I'm just going to throw in, you know, all of those folks who are talking about genetic memory, and wow.
Well, you know, Dr. Brewer, right before the break, you said something that I really appreciate, and if that message is the take-home message from the book, then I will have sort of done what I consider to be where I was heading with this, which is that psychopathy exists as a human characteristic, that it is on a gradated scale, and that it's not just an all-or-nothing diagnosis. The person that you refer to, my colleague, he was a forensic colleague, and he supported that theory, but that theory is completely counter to what I'm suggesting. There is no, you know, set of genetic, there's not a genetic predisposition that makes somebody, okay, these are the ones that we can identify and these are the ones that aren't.
Okay.
It's more that just what you said before the break, it's a human characteristic. I think when we go for those all or nothing kinds of definitions, like my colleague did, we do so in part because it makes us feel safer. We can then say, okay, there's that group of people
right.
that we have to isolate. In fact, we can even identify them genetically. Well, how convenient. Then we can just lock them away and we'll be a much better world.
Yeah, we can ignore them.
That way.
We can ignore them. We don't have to provide
right.
services. What's the point? They're gone. That's great.
Right, which it's unfortunately that doesn't work. I mean, and every time we have this conversation, I feel a need to say that I'm not suggesting that there aren't those violent, dangerous kinds of criminals that we certainly do need to have off the streets and away from us, you know. And so that's a different conversation. I'm not suggesting that, you know, there's a simple explanation here, and that, you know, if we just love everybody that things will get better. That's not what I'm suggesting, but I am suggesting that as a human characteristic, it's a sort of void in psyche, and that we can recognize glimmers of that, perhaps in ourselves or people close to us, and if we understand it from this frame of reference, the reason that that's even helpful or useful is that we can then have an idea about what might heal it. And I do think that it's through eros, it's through love in that broadest sense, that sometimes, you know, there can be some sort of transformation. And that journey is basically what I describe in terms of my father's and my relationship in the book.
Well, talk about your father's characteristics. Talk about your experience of your dad, Albert, and who he was.
Sure. My father and my mother were divorced when I was two, and he visited once when I was four or five, and that's the photo that is on the front of the book. There are two photos that have my father and me that my mom took when he came to visit us when I was four. At that point, she had taken me back to the East Coast, to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I remember that day. So that's where those photos come from. My dad was a complex character. He was tremendously charming and intelligent, and he was a gifted architect. He was a jazz drummer. He was a lot of things. He also married five times. He, after my mother and him divorced, he remarried, and he was actually in one marriage for 28 years, and there were two sets of two children that came out of two of those marriages, so those are half-siblings to me that I really, some of whom I have no relationship with, and others of whom I have a sort of fragile one. But he was an enigma because he was stable, certainly had no criminal record, no problems with drugs or alcohol. You know, I talk a little bit about his childhood and what may have helped to sort of sculpt his character. But the area that was a mystery and that caused me to consider his personality from this perspective in terms of, you know, psychopathy within, was that he could leave relationships, marriages, children, just abruptly, without so much as a backward glance. And it's not that he couldn't and didn't make loving connections. It's just that something was evidently missing. My stepmothers and a couple of my half-siblings were the ones that first referred to him, in my experience, as a psychopath or a sociopath, you know. And that, at the time, I felt sort of defensive on his behalf, and I think that was both because I wanted to defend him, but also certainly myself, both because he was my dad, and if he was one, maybe I was too, and that kind of thing. I began to think about what that meant. I was resistant to even beginning to consider him as a psychopath, because when I thought about psychopath, I was thinking in forensic terms and like, well, gosh, he's no criminal. He's never, you know, physically hurt anybody, et cetera. And then I started thinking more about the affective and interpersonal dimensions to it. So that was really the genesis of my getting into this definition of what it might mean when we say psychopathy. I didn't see him for 14 years when I was growing up, from the time I was 5 until I was 19. My mom's suggestion, and she was kind of a strong, independent person, never said anything negative really about him, but said, you know, I wouldn't, don't approach him until you don't need anything from him. And so that actually seemed good advice. And he had written, I think, a couple of times prior to that, but I, you know, it didn't lead to any kind of contact. And then when I was 19 at UC Santa Barbara, he wrote, and I answered, and I met him and that family and remained connected for the rest of his life. So,
Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certainly, you know, as you describe your dad's ability to be engaged and loving and connected and then all of a sudden not, So I start to think that, you know, so all right, so there was some disordered attachment issues for your dad. At what point does disordered attachment become sort of a pathway to psychopathy? And is that in the framework of how you think about the psychopathy within for all of us? It's somewhere attachment issues are abounding.
Well, I certainly think there's a connection between attachment issues and what we develop into, you know, in terms of our personalities later. I think it might be relevant to clarify that I'm not proposing a theory here. I really am not. It's okay. More of a description, a story about how I came to think about this. And I am hesitant to say, okay, well, because then you're kind of back to what you proposed earlier, which is that, oh, well, if this person has a disturbed relationship with their parents, excuse me, then that's why they ended up,
I see.
You know, mm-hmm. behaving like a psychopath. And I don't think there's necessarily that direct link. I mean,
okay.
Of course, I wouldn't deny that having an abusive or disturbed childhood or poor attachment to key characters and parents and that kind of thing, that wouldn't, you know, have some meaning in terms of whether we develop perhaps psychopathic tendencies or, you know, I'm hesitant to make it into that kind of a
gotcha.
Sort of a linear or chronological statement, because then it sounds more like a theory, like, mm-hmm. oh, and there is that, I mean, I share that, it's like, wouldn't it be delightful to be able to say, well, this is what causes it, and then if we just put our energies there, then we can prevent it from happening, but I don't really see it that way. I think of psychopathy, it's hard to come up with the causal factors, and probably rather than saying that we're wrong about that, it's probably more accurate to say that, you know, perhaps about a whole bunch of them. Like, there's probably a lot of different contributing factors in terms of what might either encourage the development, kind of an oxymoron, but encourage the development of psychopathy, or perhaps mitigate it. Like, if you had a really loving home and parents that you were firmly attached and that kind of thing, then one would think that it would be far less likely that you would have these gaps in your psyche and, you know, would have a problem connecting to others or to life. So I feel like I'm kind of walking around your question, but I hope I have explained.
Well, no, you know, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I think the point that you make is a useful one, because indeed, you know, there really is this, I agree with you, human propensity towards saying this thing equals that thing's not me, I'm good, you're bad, see you later. And I think you're making it clear throughout our conversation that that's not at all what you're saying. But clearly what you're raising is almost a responsibility, I would suggest, that all of us think very differently, perhaps about labels in general, but certainly about this one, in a way that many folks, I would suggest, might be uncomfortable with doing.
Right. Well, it is uncomfortable. I mean, it's far more comfortable to be able to say, okay, this category of individuals, you know, is this, and so therefore, you know, if we just get rid of them, then we'll be safe. However, you know, for better or worse, I really do think that what we find intolerable in others often has something to tell us about an aspect of ourselves. And I'm not saying that, well, gee, if I think, you know, psychopaths are bad, then that means that I'm a psychopath. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the qualities in others that make us, you know, turn them into the enemy often have something to teach us in terms of our own development. I mean, I don't know, is it okay if I refer to something in the book, because I don't know if that might, we're kind of talking about it and, in ways that I feel less I feel like I'm being less clear than I am in the book. Of course, that's a lot easier. You have time to edit and whatever, but I don't know if that would be helpful. Or
that would be very helpful. And again, the book that we're talking about is Psychopathy Within by Dr.
Correct.
Eve Merrim. Absolutely refer to something that you've written.
Okay. I'm going to do two little blurbs, and if they end up getting too long, then please flag me down. So the first one is about the PCLR, that psychopathy checklist revised that's used in the courtroom. And this was in a section where I'm talking about when I had that experience of being trained in this tool with other psychologists, and boy, these really awful murderers were getting like median scores, and I couldn't figure it out. So this is from that section. It's on page 14, actually. The breakthrough idea that shaped the PCLR was purportedly identifying and itemizing a combination of affective, interpersonal, and socially deviant lifestyle factors that comprise psychopathy, rather than just criminal traits or acts, but that never felt like a landmark distinction to me. I was introduced to Hare's trademark set of diagnostic criteria on the PCLR because it was a required tool for psychological testing and assessment in my forensic work, but regrettably, it did not, after all, prove to me that such a human characteristic could be unequivocally reduced to a finite measurement with a convenient cutoff score. In fact, my illusion had to be sacrificed. This also meant the sacrifice of another illusion, the kind of neatly defined thinking about psychopathy that justified my politely unexpressed righteous indignation when my stepmothers and siblings referred to my father as a psychopath, since he surely did not fit the diagnostic profile of one as I understood it at that point in my forensic career. So I don't know if that that's kind of addresses what we've been talking about in terms of, you know, how my thinking changed, not saying that what I was studying in terms of the forensic tools was wrong, but that it was incomplete.
It does explain it, and you make it very clear. Let's go back to talking just for a few more moments about Dad. You talked about the ways in which he could connect and then abruptly disconnect as examples. Were there any other behaviors that you were aware of that were troublesome to you or perhaps belonged somewhere along the spectrum of psychopathy?
Well, the answer to that question is no, and that's what made it so mysterious. Because if you met him, and if you, you know, had visited the home he shared with the wife he was married to for 28 years and raising those two kids, you would have thought he was a charming, intelligent, funny, engaging, even warm character. And that's, I mean, when he left relationships, it was truly out of the blue. And he just, I mean, one marriage with children, they were small at that time. These are my first two half-siblings. They were like, I think, two and baby, and without warning, he left. He just left. He left a note and moved across town. And so, I mean, the book is also, among other things, my kind of working through how do I process that? How do I make sense of it? And I knew him. I mean, he had a really good relationship with my two kids for until he died. So it's a mystery. And so part of what this book is about is my exploring that mystery with you, with whoever, you know, reads it, and in my own search to make some meaning out of this, and to, let's face it, to have some hope about this really painful experience in my life, and what I do with it, and what I do with, you know, what it means in terms of who I am, and, you know, what I experienced, all of that. I'm hoping that the book addresses that, and that's where Eros comes in. That, you know, and I did find, I do feel that in some regard I have had a healing experience just through this writing, and what I arrived at and was able to express about what went on here. And I do think it ends on a hopeful note because it talks about healing through Eros. I keep coming back to that. You know, and it does kind of, the book goes all over the place. I would say that my dad is the thread that goes throughout, truly, and the story of my father. And so hopefully the feedback I've gotten is this, that when people read that and they identify with the personal part in the story, and that maybe that helps to sort of thread all this stuff together. Because when you talk about forensics and Jung, and, you know, Jung, I didn't mention earlier, I mean, a big part of him and his ideas was the fact that he was just this, he had an incredibly rich understanding of culture, history, religion, mythology, and all of that infuses his writing and how he expresses things. I mean, I'm not even on the brink of an expert in those areas, but I draw upon him, and so that is needs to be said. I mean,
what I think, certainly, and I would agree with you that when you start talking about, certainly with these kinds of books, diagnostic terms and information and perspectives, unless it's somebody who is just interested in that kind of stuff and
right.
kind of eats it up the way I do, I have to confess, it can sort of leave them questioning. But when you add the personal story, that really does open up, I would
right.
suggest, not only the understanding of what you're talking about, but the awareness that
right.
this kind of experience could actually fit into the reader's life,
right.
into the
right.
reader's awareness. Dr. Marin, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, you mentioned a very important word. You talked about healing. And when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit about healing. This is Pamela Brewer, folks. You're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation about the psychopathy within. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Dr. Marin, let's talk about healing. We've been talking about some really pretty challenging experiences that folks may have. Healing, how does that happen? Is it possible?
Well, I believe it is, and that's what keeps me going, not personally, but also in my work, to be sure. I think the idea of the gap theory, how's that for a simplistic way to put it? That, I mean, if we think of it that way, that something's missing in terms of connecting to other people, that there's a place that's just sort of empty, then what can fill it is what I refer to and what Guggenbuehl Craig referred to as Eros, which is love in the broadest sense. And that's pretty abstract and may seem difficult to understand. But the key, I think, to any kind of a positive transformation, a transformation from, you know, this lack of ability to connect with others to being able to have compassion and empathy, the bridge there is it has to do with relationship. And you mentioned attachment earlier on, and this might be where that comes in. So even with people that have poor attachment early histories. I mean, how do we work with that? We've tried to do something to restore it, right? So we're using relationship, we're using basically love, the energy of love, in order to kind of to fill those empty places. And in a therapy relationship, that might be through just that, through a caring and insightful therapist or psychologist who can really see this person for who they are and can work with them and join them in the shared field of the struggle that this person has. I mean, it may be that. It could, you know, lots of personal ramifications. I mean, that's one of the things about the work that we do as psychologists and therapists, I think, is that it's also personal. It has to do, you know, that who we are in the world has everything to do with who we are in our with our clients. I mean, and I think the feedback that I've gotten from people who've read this, interestingly enough, even the forensic people, is that what touches them and what creates an opening for them to perhaps explore a different way of looking at psychopathy is the personal dimension, the fact that my heart is in this book. I mean, when I talk about my father and my relationship, talk about feeling exposed. I mean, I'm kind of I'm right out there. So, I mean, and I think even the journey of the book itself is an example of healing through Eros, okay? Because I had this painful experience in my own growing up in my own life, a painful absence of a father who never really was there for me, let's put it that way. And I formed a kind of loving relationship with him, I think, because that was something that I wanted and needed, and I kind of made it happen. But there was a lot that you know, I had a dream that was never realized, let's put it that way. And yet, in terms of my healing, telling the story of our relationship and what it taught me about myself and, you know, a way to perceive others in the world. I mean, the whole process of writing has been a healing journey for me. So whatever empty spaces there are in me, certainly I have discovered that by telling the story, and that's a form of Eros activity, this
absolutely
passionate, creative effort, that it is transformative. I don't feel the same way about my own journey that I did before I completed this writing.
You know, and that, just as an aside, that, you know, so often I talk to my clients about the value and the power of writing, and what you're saying just absolutely underscores that repeatedly. So I thank you for that, because it really is a very, very powerful tool that you own, that's yours.
Right. Well, it's an expression of what of an inner process, and as soon as we do that, then it's no longer something we hold in isolation. Then it's a form of bridge, you know, to a witness or to someone who shares that with you. And I think, I mean, for me, it certainly is writing, but I mean, I think it can be other things too. I mean, it can be other forms of creativity. I mean, some people do, you know, maybe it's art or it's dance or music, or, you know, I mean, but something that connects you to the world and reaches out to others. I don't know that it even has to be that collective. It may just be a relationship, you know. But, yeah.
Well, the idea that one can open up oneself and experience healing versus harm, which what keeps a lot of folks inside themselves, is in and of itself, I think, a gift. And I want to get back to the forensic piece of this, where you're, you know, applying the checklist and really taking a look at who one can predict will be safe to release and who one can predict will not. Is it reasonable to imagine that if all of us, but certainly the court system take into consideration what you were offering in Psychopathy Within, that there would be a very different approach to counseling, to therapy with these folks who, even if they are deemed to be psychopaths, there's still a way to work with them versus essentially throwing them into solitary confinement. Perhaps not literally, but, you know, essentially.
Yeah, that's tricky. I mean, it's just, I think our court, our legal system is certainly imperfect, and I don't think that there's, I mean, most people that work within it in some capacity agree that it's not perfect, but the reality is I don't have an idea about, you know, what we could plug in to take its place. I mean, it's a faulty system, and I think perhaps the way it might change is well, the potential anyway, would be, you know, what you're proposing, that if there was some avenue for a different kind of understanding about, you know, this kind of understanding, that there's a range of characteristics, that people aren't all or nothing, you know, in terms of their criminal propensities and in terms of their psychopathy, that would make a difference. I mean, we've been trying for a long time to get treatment programs of different kinds into the prisons with pretty minimal success, you know. So even though our prison system in California is still called the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, which suggests that some sort of a healing is supposed to be taking place there. I mean, what we offer in that regard is not what it could be, to be sure. And so it just sort of perpetuates the problems. But I don't really think there's much chance that on a broad scale, the legal system or the court system would take up my book and say, oh, I see things differently now. We'll put this person into therapy. But I think the way that it does change is more subtle and nuanced. And the example that comes to mind is that I had a book signing, like a party that was thrown for me. It was very sweet. It was, and it was by my forensic colleagues. I had anticipated that the initial response I got would be more, you know, from the Jungians, but the first and really quite overwhelming response to me anyway was from my forensic colleagues. And at this book signing, hosted by a friend of ours who was on the forensic panel, I should mention my husband is also Wes Merrim. He's a forensic psychologist as well, and so this was a friend of ours from the panel, and he and his wife threw this party, and it was attended primarily by forensic professionals and, you know, and friends and family and attorneys. And I kind of shuddered and thought, oh, wow, you know, this is like the last audience on earth that is likely to be able to hear this stuff. And it was incredibly friendly, and they were warm. And, you know, one person I never have heard anything personal from came up to me and says, oh, you know, I had a bad dad, too. I mean, she's a witness, like an expert witness in the court, and, you know, just the personality you would never, you know, associate mm-hmm. with making a statement like that. And she actually wrote an endorsement for the book, Amy Phoenix. So it's just, it touches, I think if it can touch people, then, you know, those people, at least the people that went to that gathering, will go forth in the world, and maybe they will, you know, perceive what they do or the individuals they encounter in the context of the legal system with slightly different lenses. That's about all I can hope for, is slightly different lenses. And it's, you know, little by little and sort of unpredictable. But, I mean, if it should happen in a broader way, I don't know. I mean, it seems rather unlikely given our current cultural situation. But in this country, you know, who knows?
You know, sometimes a slightly different lens is all that it takes to make a huge difference. But it's interesting, as you mentioned, that there were attorneys there. So then I'm thinking, okay, were these defense attorneys, because I could see them really liking the book,
or were these
prosecutors, I could see them really hating the book.
Mostly the latter. That's why I thought there's no way. I mean, but what's surprising, I mean, it's the humanity in people, and that's what this book encourages. It's encouraging us as individuals to recognize the humanity in others. There's nothing more important in terms of, like, with my husband runs a treatment program. We have all these, you know, psychologists, you know, psych assistants, that kind of thing. Some learning, you know, to work as therapists, and I do some supervision there. And part of what the hurdle for them, if they're dealing with, you know, individuals that are referred by probation and parole, is how can you not keep these assumptions that leap into your thinking, you know, dealing with somebody when they've read their rap sheet or whatever, and yet in order to get anywhere in therapy with them, what they have to do is recognize the humanity in the individual. That doesn't mean you accept or even tolerate whatever they may have done,
right,
the behavior that you find unacceptable and is unacceptable, but to somehow see within this individual also who they are as a human being, and to become more in touch with that in yourself, so that informs how you relate to others.
You know, again, I think that the more that we are able to perhaps drop some of the labels, and I do think there's value to labels in some context, but to the extent that we can drop labels as the thing that we use to entomb people,
right,
and be more open to the broad range of the human experience, perhaps there is more that we can do to really heal the society from one individual to the next to the next.
Right. I have a paragraph. It's kind of a short one. Would you mind if I read that? Because it kind of addresses, it's towards the end, but it kind of pulls some of this together.
That's,
is that okay?
Absolutely fine.
Okay. Here we go. This is on 271. Says, our own psychopathy may be most evident when we examine those people and ideas we judge most harshly, since what we find most intolerable within we tend to project elsewhere, which is also why, as we heal within, we bring positive change to the world. Love, like psychopathy, has a gradated definition, and the presence of one aspect does not preclude the other. But love holds the potential to positively transform our inner emptiness with caring, meaning, and purpose. In symbolic terms, illuminating psychopathy within, those empty places in the soul where the light of love has yet to enter, may also invoke one's healing inner muse. The healing remedy for psychopathy within might appear in the form of creativity inspired by Eros. So,
thank you. I think that's a absolutely wonderful way to put closure to our conversation today. I very much appreciate your taking the time to sort of walk us through your experiences and the psychopathy within. Is there a website or a place where people can go to get more information about what you're doing?
There is, and I mean, the book is available on Amazon, so if you want to go right to that, that would work, but my website is it's http://, and then all one word, lowercase, no dots, no caps, drevemaram.com.
Okay, so that's EVEMARAM.com.
Correct.
Terrific. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brewer.
My pleasure.
I appreciate the opportunity.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. A reminder that Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org is the way to go. That's mindtalk.org. And again, you can go to the homepage of mindtalk.org every day for a new program, or you can download the brand new Mind Talk app at the iTunes store. And folks, I just want to remind you, If it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take it.